Welcome to Everyday Musicality, the podcast in which we discuss all things related to Gordon's music learning theory and how it can help unlock the inner musician that lives inside of all of us. I'm your host, Heather Scholdeis, music educator and faculty member for the Gordon Institute for Music Learning. In this episode, I share audio from an interview about giving children the gift of musical understanding. Hello and welcome to the Everyday Musicality Podcast. Things have been very busy over here. All good things, but very busy things. One thing that's been taking up a lot of my time over the last few weeks is that I have been busy working on some music education program revision proposals that we will be moving through our input process at Eastern Michigan University, where I teach. And so I've been having to put together a whole lot of materials in support of the changes we want to make to our music education program and document that will support the need for those changes. So that has been eating up a lot of my spare time lately, which means that unfortunately I was not able to script the episode that I hoped to have out for you today on harmony at the aural-oral and verbal association skill levels. I think I've mentioned before on the podcast that I do all of this by myself, and a new episode typically takes somewhere around 3 to 5 hours for me to produce. It typically takes me an hour or two to script each episode, and then another hour or two or more to record and then edit the episode. So I was not able to have a new, freshly produced episode for you this week, but to tide you over, I didn't want to leave you hanging, so I'm going to be sharing today some audio from an interview that I was invited to do with Catherine Brunner, who is the owner of Music at Home, and she invited me to do an interview that she could share with parents of her students about giving children the gift of musical understanding. So she asks a lot of good questions in this interview. There's a lot of good information, and even if it might not be completely new to you, if you are an MLT veteran, maybe it will be helpful to hear the spin that we put on what we do for parents to help parents understand the value of musical experiences and the unique contribution that music learning theory can make in helping build our children's musical experiences. So Catherine graciously agreed to let me share the audio of our interview, and that's what you're going to be hearing today. I hope you enjoy it.
Welcome, everyone. It is wonderful to have you here. Our presentation today is entitled How to Give Your Child the Gift of Musical Understanding. And that's my goal as a teacher, is to give that to my students. And I know as a parent, you want your child to have that gift. And that's why I've invited Dr. Heather Scholdeis to join us today. She is extremely gifted in clearly and concisely talking about the gift of music education. And so, Heather, it's wonderful to have you here. And before we jump in, I'd love to share with everyone a bit about your background. So let's jump in. Dr. Heather Nelson Scholdeis is an associate professor of music education at Eastern Michigan University, where she coordinates the music education program, teaches graduate and undergraduate courses, supervises student teachers, and directs the early childhood music program through EMU's Community Music Academy. Dr. Scholdeis's research and writing have been published in many, many, many academic music journals. And she has recently authored a book called Weaving It All Together, A Practical Guide to Applying Gordon's Music Learning Theory in the Elementary General Music Program. Prior to entering higher education, Dr. Scholdeis taught elementary general music for 10 years in the public schools of Michigan. She currently serves as immediate past president of the Gordon Institute for Music Learning, for which she also is a professional development faculty member in elementary general music. Recently, Dr. Schuldeis began hosting and producing a podcast called Everyday Musicality, Unlocking the Inner Musician Through MLT, which is how I found Heather, which is also the podcast is available on all podcast streaming apps and on the web. Dr. Schuldeis also publishes a blog called Research to Real Life, which summarizes recent music education research studies and provides practical suggestions for the classroom. There's so much more we could say because Heather, you are so gifted and it is such a joy to have you here today. So welcome. I would love for you to share with us a little bit about what the journey in music education is like as we think about music like learning a language, learning music like learning a language. How are those two paths parallel?
Sure. And actually, that's a great opening question, because had I not started thinking about that question, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. Because it was when I started thinking about music learning as similar to how we learn our native language, that's what really made me go, whoa, there are so many amazing things that young children can do musically that I never imagined were possible. Mm-hmm. Until I flipped basically everything I thought I knew about music teaching and learning, I flipped it upside down and backwards and inside out. And that's mm-hmm. what really got me excited about music education. I hope no one minds my cat, by the way. He wants to sleep for a little
while. You're giving me chills because you're speaking my language. I love it. Yes.
So if we think about, because it's been theorized by a number of individuals, but in the last half century or so, it had been really emphasized by a music education scholar and psychologist, Dr. Edwin E. Gordon, that he theorized that we really learn music in a process parallel to that in which we learn our native language. So if we think for a minute about how we learn our native language when we're born, we come out into the world primed to learn any language on the planet. And then it's the experiences that we have that form our literacy ability. So when we are born, we first start by listening. We hear all the language sounds in our environment, and we're like a little sponge. We just soak up all those language sounds and we become acculturated to the sounds of our native language. And, you know, it's not like anyone sits us in a corner and doesn't ever speak to us, right? Mm-hmm. Parents, caregivers, siblings are always talking with the baby in the native language. So they're hearing all those sounds. Mm-hmm. And then when that child is developmentally ready, they start to play with the sounds. And right, we talk about how those sounds first are what we would call babble. Mm-hmm. So the child just starts to imitate the sounds, ba, ba, ba. And I'm assuming since this is a video for parents, that everyone watching this video has heard a child babble before. I'm guessing they've also heard a child babble before where clearly that child is trying to say something. Mama, right? They're babbling with some kind of expressiveness that says they are intent on communicating something. But the catch is they don't yet realize that the sounds coming out of their mouths don't match the sounds coming out of our mouths, right? It's not intelligible to us yet as correct words, correct. Mm-hmm. And so we don't, you know, sit the child in the corner until they're ready to speak correctly. We don't try to correct them. We just keep engaging with them. And maybe we try to interpret what they're saying, their babbling sounds, to have meaning. So if the child's saying baba, baba, we might say, oh, baba, bottle. You want your bottle, baba. So we might put their babble sounds next to words so the child can start comparing and breaking that code of being able to speak intelligible words. Or we might, if we don't know what the child's trying to say, we might just imagine something. So if the child's babbling, we might say, well, yes, it is a beautiful day out today. What should we do? And you just keep facilitating that process of the back and forth with language that really gets their language acquisition going. And then eventually they break that code of forming their first real word and their language vocabulary explodes. They learn hundreds and thousands of words that they can put together to express their thoughts and their needs. Eventually we learn to think in language. Isn't that wild to think about the fact that we don't come out of the womb thinking in language? We don't have that inner capacity yet. So we have to develop that.
And as we develop that ability to think in language, we develop the ability to express our thoughts that we're having through language, so conversing. And it's not till much later that we formally learn how to read or write, right? And what's probably the first word that you or I learned to read or write? What would you say?
I don't know. Our name.
Probably, right?
Yeah.
That's the most familiar word to you. You know exactly what that word is. You've heard it a million times. That's you. And now it's just a matter of here's what it looks like. And here's how we can make those symbols happen ourselves, right? We start with what's familiar. And then we can move on to what's unfamiliar. And only after we're reading and writing fluently do we learn about like the theory behind language, right? Like word etymologies or parts of speech, you know, the stuff that we learned in English class, like gerunds and participles and all that stuff that we forget really quickly, because once we're fluent in the language, we kind of don't need that stuff, right? Because we just have a sense of the language and we have functional use of the language. So if we think of that flow of listening, speaking, being able to have our own thoughts and express those thoughts through conversation, and then later reading and writing, and even after that is the theory of language. In music, we are thinking that music development actually happens in a parallel process. Now, notice I didn't say how we teach music. I'll get to that in a minute. But how we naturally learn music happens through a similar process. So first, we need to hear lots of music to be immersed in a rich musical environment where we're hearing lots of tonalities and meters and styles and genres and expressive qualities and all these things. And that gives us a rich listening vocabulary to build on. As we're hearing lots of musical sounds, we start to play with musical sounds. We start to experiment with our singing voices. We start to experiment with moving our bodies rhythmically. And maybe it's not correct at first, but we don't need someone to teach us or formally correct us, just like we wouldn't say to a baby, no, you didn't say bottle right. It's like this bottle, but right? We wouldn't do that with language. That would be ridiculous. Same thing in music. We don't need to correct students right away. We just need to keep engaging them in experiences that will scaffold their music acquisition. And when they're ready, they'll use their singing voice accurately. They'll move their body rhythmically. And then later, we can take that musical understanding and apply it to the symbols of notation. We can show them how the sounds that they already are hearing and performing and understanding look in notation, how we can write those in notation. And then later we would learn the theory behind music. So things like half steps and whole steps and, you know, every good boy does fine for the lines of the treble clef staff, all those kinds of things that traditionally we jump to right away. Right. I don't know about you, but I started taking violin lessons when I was 5 because my older sister played violin and I wanted to be just like her. And so I remember my very first violin book. I remember there was a picture of Mr. Quarternote and I colored Mr. Quarternote. And then there were the lines on the staff with the letters and I colored the letters. But I had no idea what any of that meant. I had no understanding of the sounds that those symbols represented. So in a way, it was like teaching music backwards. And I think that's traditionally, unfortunately, what we've done. And I think that hampers our musical development in a lot of ways because we learn to rely on the notation and music theory as a crutch for what we're not understanding through our ears and hearing in our musical minds. So if we can help children learn first through their ears musically and developing their musical thinking, then reading and writing and music theory comes so much more easily later on when we keep that process, just like we learn our native language. If we can use that same progression, children can do amazing things musically.
That is fantastic, Heather. As you're speaking, I'm thinking of my own experience as a child, and it really matches what you said, because I would come home from school and from church as a little 6 or 7 year old prior to starting lessons and play everything I heard on the piano. I would just play it. And I didn't know what was happening. I just knew I loved the music. I could feel it inside and I could create it and make it happen through my fingers. And then when I started lessons and I had to decode everything off the page, it did not translate to me. And that's what I think is so beautiful about this parallel that you're making, because when we approach music that way, it's so much more natural than what I experienced and what you experienced. And I can only imagine children who are able to go down this path and what their musicianship will look like in the future. I mean, you and I are professional musicians. That's what we do. But wow, I would have loved to had a teacher come alongside me as a young child to teach me music this very natural way that my brain is designed for. So thank you. That's amazing. So how can parents help their children understand the language of music? What are some ways that you would recommend?
Sure. Well, I think the most important in my mind is to establish that rich music listening environment at home, mm-hmm. to play lots of music in your home, lots of different styles, different genres of music, so that kids can really build that rich listening vocabulary. But more importantly, to engage in music with your child. So not just playing recorded music, but to sing with your child, to move with your child rhythmically and encourage them to engage in active music making. So providing that rich listening environment, but also interacting with your child musically. And then I think also is as much as possible to make it enjoyable. Like you were saying, when you would just figure things out by ear on the piano, it was fun. It was fulfilling. It was something you really wanted to do. And I think that's key to motivating our children to learn music, is to make it enjoyable, make it fun, make it fulfilling. So that would be my advice for parents.
I love that. Absolutely. And so this pathway for learning music, like learning a language, I know you mentioned the research of Dr. Edwin Gordon. I would love for you to tell us a little bit about how he, or just the development of music learning theory. What is music learning theory, and how does that translate into music learning, just like we learn a language?
Sure. So Edwin Gordon was a musical performer. He actually got his degree in bass performance, and he toured with Gene Krupa's band playing bass for Gene Krupa. But prior to that, I think the interesting thing behind his story, and I don't know how much of how many of your families would be familiar with his name, but I think something really interesting to know about him is that he had an experience as a young child where he was in class in school. And at that time, so he passed away in 2015. I think he was born in the 1920s. So this, to give you a sense of when this happened, when he was in elementary school, they would label the kids that were good singers as the bluebirds. And then the kids who were not as good singers were labeled the blackbirds. And Ed Gordon was actually labeled a blackbird when he was a young child. And he was asked to not actually sing at the concert. He was asked to just move his lips. And I think that is so powerful, because there's so much research out there that shows there are so many adults who walk around feeling like they're not musical, like they can't sing. And sadly, a lot of that started when they were in music classes or music lessons as a child, that somewhere along the line, they got this message, maybe not as explicitly as Ed Gordon, but they got some message that music wasn't for them, that it's not something they're good at, or that not something that's possible for them. And sadly, that leads a lot of people to never make music again for the rest of their lives. Now, luckily, Ed Gordon was a pretty opinionated person and pretty stubborn. And I think that experience of being labeled a blackbird angered him. And it kind of like led to this mission in life to prove that teacher wrong. Like I said, he ended up going on to perform bass and then got into music education and really started thinking about, okay, how do we learn when we learn music? We know how we've traditionally taught music, but how do we actually learn music? And so that became his life's work, working in music psychology, doing research on how kids actually learn when they learn music. And that's all that music learning theory is. It sounds simple. There's a lot to it, but music learning theory is simply a theory about how we as human beings learn when we learn music. And it is based on that idea that we already talked about, this idea that the way we learn music parallels the way we learn our native language. So hearing and doing music using our ears first. So the sound before the sight. So before putting notation in front of students in music learning theory, first we just immerse them in sounds and let them make music using their ears. Then we help them transition to notation, and then later on to music theory. So sound before sight, I'm sorry, sound before sight before theory. That's what I was trying to get at. So that's the gist of music learning theory. There's lots of details to it, but I think for the purposes of your audience, that's probably sufficient unless you have further questions.
Yeah, I'm just curious. Could you comment briefly on the skill learning sequence? I know you just mentioned it in a nutshell there, but just how we start, like you mentioned earlier, in that babble phase, and then we move out of that. Could you just comment on a few of those phases?
Sure. Yeah. So the idea with the skill learning sequence, which is a framework at the heart of music learning theory, it's a framework that guides the sequencing of how we can help people develop musical skills. This might be children, but it also could apply to adults as well. And it's kind of builds on that idea of, you know, first when we're young, we're listening, we're kind of babbling, we're figuring out how to use our singing voice, we're figuring out how to coordinate our body so that we can move rhythmically and chant and play and sing rhythmically. And then eventually we break that code where we can find our singing voice and we can match a pitch. We can move to a steady beat with some degree of accuracy. And at that point, a child would be ready for learning through this skill learning sequence. And so it's a structure where there's two different kinds of learning. One kind of learning is basically learning by rote. So a student is using their ears and they're going off of a musical model, usually a teacher, but it could be family members or other students as well. But seeing a musical model, hearing a musical model, and then responding to what that model's doing. So learning by rote with what's familiar. The other kind of learning in the skill learning sequence is called inference learning. And that's where we take what we've already learned by rote with familiar material and we do something new with it. We might create our own music, or we might hear some unfamiliar musical sounds we've never heard before. And we might practice some sort of skill with those new sounds, applying what we've already learned by rote to something new. That's the general structure. And if you would like, I don't know if you were planning on linking to the podcast in this video, but it's geared towards music teachers, but I do think there are some episodes that parents could get something out of as well. Specifically, the first three are all about core tenets of music learning theory. So those would be great ones for parents to listen to. And then also a little later, somewhere between episodes 5 through 10, I do an episode that gives an overview of the skill learning sequence. So if this is interesting to anyone, they can feel free to go and listen to that episode.
Absolutely. That's a fantastic recommendation. I actually listen to your podcast all the time with my girls. And as we're driving in the car on the way home from school, we're thinking about all the different tonalities, major, minor, and several others that there are to really internalize. So that's been a joy for us. And I would absolutely recommend that to all parents who are eager to dive in and learn more about the nuts and bolts of music learning theory. So what would you say is the difference that this kind of learning sequence makes for a child versus a more traditional type of on-ramp to learning music?
Sure. I think the main thing for me is that I have seen how this sort of sequence, this sequential approach to music teaching and learning, is so powerful in helping children do amazing things musically, because it helps them every step of the way. Because the experience is so sequential, they are ready for each progressive step in the learning process. There's another music educator whose name is John Feyerabend. He actually studied with Ed Gordon. He did his doctoral work at Temple University with Ed Gordon and then developed his own materials. But I've read before that Feyerabend uses the terms effortful learning and effortless learning. So effortful learning, I'm sure we've all had that experience where we're just not getting something. We don't understand. We're being told how to do it. It's explained to us. We still don't get it. We're not ready. And no amount of practicing or pushing is going to help. It's just so effortful. And he contrasts that with effortless learning, where you see the thing that you're supposed to be doing and boom, you can just pick up on it because you're ready for it. And that's the beauty of music learning theory, is that if we as teachers, if we take the burden of thinking, how can I set this up in a step-by-step manner that's going to get the student from point A to point B all the way to point Z? If we invest that thinking in providing a sequential experience for our students, it pays dividends for them because they're ready for every experience that they have with us in our lessons or in our classes. And it's just beautiful to see that effortless learning happen. There's a quote I like from Ed Gordon, his book, Learning Sequences in Music. I quote it in my book, but it's when we engage students in sequential music learning experiences, everything students are learning builds logically from what they have already learned. As a result, students find what they are learning makes sense. So again, it just speaks to the power of if our students have the readiness for what it is we're trying to teach them, they just do it. They pick up on it. And so I think that's the power.
And it's so satisfying too. There's something in it that builds so much confidence and brings so much joy to students. And I've seen it in so many of my own students. I've seen it in my own children as they apply these concepts. And last night we were practicing a little piece called Seashell. We changed this little major piece, bum, 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 ba-dum, ba-dum, into a little minor tune, bum, 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 ba-dum, ba-dum. And then we changed the chords and we made them, we turned it into a little Dorian melody with a subtonic. There's so many wonderful things you can do when you understand this. And my daughter's 7. She can learn this and create with music in a way that is so fulfilling. And it does, like you said, truly make sense. So thank you. I love that quote.
You got me thinking of something that is it okay if I just share?
Absolutely.
I mentioned previously how it was this idea of sequential learning and learning like we learn our native language that got me interested in music education. Prior to that, music education was just my backup plan. I wanted to go into music performance and music ed was going to be my backup plan so that I could have a paycheck if I needed it. But what really got me excited about music education was seeing the things that were possible for young children musically, hearing what they were doing, hearing them improvise over like a given harmonic progression and seeing these things as an undergraduate music major and thinking, if somebody asked me to do this, I would be terrified. And I am a music major. And just the idea that as a music major, I don't know how many of your parents are aware of this, but if you go to college to major in music, you have to take a class called aural skills, A-U-R-A-L, aural skills. And if you think about it, that just shows that in a way we're teaching music backwards because mm-hmm. these students who learn in a sequential way and they learn through their ears, just like they learn their native language, they develop aural skills all along. Yeah. And they can use their ears to figure things out musically and to improvise and compose and all these things that as an undergraduate music major, I didn't feel like I could do them comfortably. I was scared to do them. And yet here can be even, elementary school kids doing these things.
And the interesting thing is, like you said, that's the first time you encounter that kind of learning as it is in college, usually in a traditional learning, environment in traditional lessons and even in school. So it was the same for me. My entire class was freaking out about the aural skills class because, well, we've never had to do this before. And so doing it all along is so beautiful and so natural for children. So that is the invitation here, is to say, look, there is something so much better and even more fulfilling for a music learning pathway. And that's what we're offering. And like you said, it does take so much more effort on the part of the teacher. That's why there may be not as many music learning theory teachers around the United States yet, but there are plenty of us out there and the numbers are growing. So very, very exciting. A few more questions, Heather. What guidance would you give to parents who are wondering if it's the right time for their child to begin learning an instrument?
Sure. I think first and foremost, the key is the child expressing interest and are they excited? I think if we don't start with that, it's going to be a battle. if we just think, well, you're X years old and now it's time to start piano lessons or something like that. Or people often ask me about my daughter who's six, aren't you going to start her in lessons? Well, no, she hasn't said she wanted to, and I don't want to force her. The last thing I want to do is put her in lessons and have it be a negative experience and have her completely shut down to that for the future. So I would say, first and foremost, is your child asking? And, or maybe if you bring it up, are they excited? Are they really wanting to do that thing? Because I think that speaks a lot to how motivated they're going to be in their learning. And that's important. And when I say motivated, I don't mean, tracking like how many minutes they practice or that kind of thing. I mean, like, do they have that inner drive? Sort of like what you mentioned you had as a child, that inner drive to just, I just want to play. Or, you know, they just want to experiment. They have that drive to engage with the instrument. I think that's important. Yeah. So I think that's the most important thing. I would say then, so if the interest is there, if the excitement is there, then next would be readiness. So is your child musically ready to start learning an instrument? Because, you know, we think about how we learn music, like we learn our native language, learning through our ears, experimenting with musical sounds, kind of musically babbling like we do with language, and eventually breaking that code of, oh, here's how I use my singing voice, and here's how I can match a pitch, and here's how I can move my body to a steady beat, right? So the music's in here. And I like to think of an instrument as just being an extension of that. So you're taking the music that's in here, and instead of using your voice to sing and bring it out that way, you're bringing it out with your hands on a piano keyboard. Or I'm a clarinetist, so I'm bringing it out, you know, with my embouchure and my fingers. But the music starts in here. And so I think that's the other important thing to consider is your child able to move rhythmically? Can they coordinate their body to a steady beat? Can they discriminate between different pitches? So if you were to sing short patterns of pitches to them, could they echo some short pitches back to you? If they can do that, and if they can move their body rhythmically, if they can keep a steady beat, then I think they're ready developmentally to learn an instrument and to have those sounds that they're already hearing in their head be able to come up through their instrument. Not to say that you can't work on developing those skills of matching pitch and feeling beat simultaneously or concurrently while you're learning an instrument, but both are important. It's not just what do I do with my hands and those kinds of things.
That's fantastic. That is exactly what I believe early childhood music education is all about. In all of my classes, that's what parents get to experience, is that movement, that connection with their child, those pattern echoes, rhythm echoes, all sorts of wonderful ways to prepare the mind and the body for the time when they're ready to learn an instrument. But not just for that, for the sake of music itself. Music is so rich, enriching for our lives. And whether your child is going to go on to learn an instrument, you know, it is worth the time to spend with them. Because I'd love to just chat as we wrap up here about music aptitude and the window that we have to help our children reach their full musical potential. Would you be willing to comment on that?
Sure. Yeah. Music aptitude, as you mentioned, is our potential to learn music. So there's music achievement, and those are the things that we can see and hear. You know, I could ask you to play the piano, or I could ask you to sing, or I could ask you to read some music notation, and all of the behaviors that you would show would be music achievement. And that's what you've already learned, the skills you've already developed musically. But under the surface is your music aptitude, what your potential is to achieve musically. And I don't like to think of it as how much you can achieve necessarily, but how easy or how hard it's going to be for one person to achieve at the same level of someone else. So someone with a higher music aptitude might be able to figure out things pretty quickly musically on their own. And someone with a lower music aptitude might be able to still achieve a heck of a lot, but maybe it'll take a little more practice. Maybe they'll need a good skilled teacher who can guide them. Maybe they need more encouragement, someone really motivating them to keep persisting if things get hard. So I just always like to stress that music aptitude is not about tracking people into, you know, who's musical and who's not. Everybody's musical, and every single human being is born with music aptitude. Just like nobody is born with zero IQ, nobody is born with zero music aptitude. And therefore, if we all have musical potential, we all have the capability to turn that musical potential into music achievement by, for example, learning to use our singing voice and singing in tune. Not that we have to get up on a stage and perform for everyone, right? But just that we can sing in our daily lives. We can go to church and we can sing a hymn. We can sing happy birthday in tune at a birthday party. We can sing a lullaby to our child. And I love how you mentioned before that music is so enriching for us as humans. Doesn't matter if it's going to be someone's career path, but just the fact that that is such a vital element to our humanity that we can interact with and engage with and you know, form relationships through, that's really the important thing.
It is. Yeah. And can you comment on the window for music aptitude?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So we're all born with music aptitude. And when we're born, there is just this explosive time of brain development in a young child's life. I think the statistic I recall is about 90% of the synapses formed in the brain are formed within the first year of life. I mean, that's wild when you think about it, how powerful that period of time is in a young child's brain development. And so because of that, because of how flexible the brain is during our early years, we go through these critical periods of development where we can really grow and develop a whole lot if we're exposed to things that are going to nurture our development. So if you think of, picture there being like musical parts of the brain. Parts of the brain that are devoted to music. If a baby is born and they're exposed to music, someone sings to them, those musical parts of that child's brain are going to be stimulated. Synapses are going to be formed, and you're making these connections in the brain that will last for their entire musical life. Unfortunately, the opposite can also happen. If a baby is born and they aren't exposed to a rich musical environment, maybe there's just not a lot of music played in the home, nobody sings in the home, then those musical parts of the brain aren't going to be stimulated. And the brain doesn't want to be inefficient, doesn't want to be wasteful. It's that idea of use it or lose it. So if the musical parts of the brain aren't being stimulated, then those will most likely be put to use for some other thing, right? Like maybe a better sense of sight or, you know, math or something. There's an experiment that Ed Gordon actually quoted in some of his writings that was done. You wouldn't be able to get away with this today, I don't think, but there were some scientists who took a kitten at birth and they actually sutured its eye shut. So like stitches, they sutured its eyelids together. And then after a certain amount of time, I can't remember how much it was, but after a certain amount of time, they undid the sutures, opened the kitten's eye, and it was still blind for life in that eye. Because during that critical period of brain development, the parts of the brain devoted to sight in that eye weren't being stimulated. And so they were put to use for other things, and sight could never be regained in that eye. So that just speaks to the power of, if we expose children to music from birth and we sing to them, we move with them, we chant to them rhythmically, it's going to nurture their music aptitude, those musical parts of their brain, and keep their potential as high as possible. So that later on in life, Ed Gordon theorized that our aptitude stabilizes. He theorized approximately around the age of 9, but before he died, he was actually saying, well, I think maybe it theorizes a little bit later than I initially thought, or maybe there's a little more flexibility there. But the idea being that at some point in our brain development, there's a process called myelination, where like the brain wants to be efficient and streamlined. And so to make everything work more efficiently and effectively, it develops this like fatty sheath. I'm not a brain scientist, but this is like my primitive knowledge of brain development. And when that happens, to make things run faster and more efficiently in the brain, that's why he theorized that around the age of 9, it's harder to change our music aptitude because the brain is less plastic, less, you know, open to change. And so that's why for the first, you know, 10 years or so of a child's life, we have tremendous power to really nurture their music aptitude, keep it as high as possible, so they can achieve as much as possible and as easily as possible for the rest of their lives musically. And that's not to say that if we haven't been exposed to a lot of music past the age of 9, that we're doomed. musically, right? Our brain can always learn and grow and do so much more. But it's just going to be easier if we are exposed to music earlier in our lives.
It's so exciting. It's an incredible journey to be on as a parent and as a music educator. And it's just, it's a wonderful invitation for parents to say, let's do this together. And that's what I love to do. And that's my life's calling. And I know it's your life's calling too, is to make this happen for students as well as equip teachers. So it's really, really exciting. So thank you, Heather, for being on our program today. We can truly give children the gift of musical understanding, and you have helped us understand more of how to make that happen. So thank you. And I want to wish you all the best in your future endeavors of teaching.
Thank you so much, Catherine. It was great to be speaking with you today.
Awesome.
Well, I hope that was interesting and informative, and I hope to be back with you in 2 weeks with brand new episodes and new content. Also, I wanted to let you know before I leave for today of a few upcoming events that are music learning theory related. If you are a member of GIML, the Gordon Institute for Music Learning, they have their upcoming faculty hangout on Wednesday, October 26th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. That is going to be a choral share with GIML faculty member Andy Mullen. So feel free to check that out. Free for GIML members. If you'd like to attend, just visit www.giml.org for more information. Also on the GIML website, you'll find out that one of our GIML chapters, the Ohio GIML chapter, is going to be holding an event that is a virtual workshop on Saturday, October 22nd from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern. And that event is going to be presented by Enrique Andino, one of the co-authors of the brand new MLT-based method for guitar. So if you want to check that out, you can find more information on the GIML website. I believe that is a ticketed event online, but it is, $10 for GIML members and $20 for non-members. So I hope you will check that out. In the meantime, if you have questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes, please get in touch. You can email me or send me a voice memo at everydaymusicality@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. Thanks for listening, and let's keep musicking every day.